of the chill that inhabited that place, that gnawed into your bones and soul like an ancient and ugly spiritual rheumatism. Even Narayan Singh felt it. He hunched over the fire, twitching as though he expected a blow from behind at any minute. He muttered something about his faith having been tested enough. I do not belong to an empathetic and compassionate brotherhood. Those who offend us must look forward to moments of extreme discomfort. Should God, in his magnanimity, see fit to present us with the opportunity to provide it? And our antipathy toward Narayan Singh was so old it had become ritual. So it was not with any commiseration that I told him, We're prepared to make the exchange. Our first Book of the Dead for your key. His head came up. He stared at me directly. The true Narayan behind the masked Narayan, considering me coldly. Wariness took life in the corners of his eyes.
How could?
Never mind. We have it. A swap was the deal. And we're ready to swap now. Calculation began to replace caution. I would have bet a handsome sum he was assessing his chances of murdering us in our sleep, so he would not have to keep his side of the bargain. It would be, perhaps, a less elegant solution than mass murder, Narayan. But why not just do the deal the way we agreed? I shivered. The temple seemed to be getting colder, if that was possible. In fact, I'll give you a bonus. Once you hand over the key, you can go. Away. Free. As long as you vow not to screw with the Black Company anymore. A vow he would make in an instant, I was sure. Such vows being worth the bark they are written on when they spring from the mouths of deceivers. Kina would not expect him to keep faith with an unbeliever.
A truly generous offer, analyst.
Singh replied, suspiciously.
Let me sleep on it.
By all means. I snapped my fingers. Iqbal and Runmust broke out the shackles. Put the goat bells on him tonight, too. We had several of those, to go with the several goats. Once attached to Narayan's shackles, they made a racket whenever he moved. He was a stealth master, but not master enough to keep the bells from betraying him. But don't be surprised if I don't feel as generous when light and warmth return to the world. Darkness always comes, but the sun also rises. I had my blanket around me already. I pulled it tighter and lay down. Squirmed a little in a vain attempt to get comfortable, then fell into the sort of evil, haunted dreams apparently experienced by anyone who passes the night in the Grove of Doom. I was aware that I was dreaming, and I was familiar with the dreamscapes, though I had never visited them myself. Both Lady and Mergen had written about them. The visual elements did not trouble me terribly, but nothing had prepared me for the stench, which was the stink of thousand-week-old battlefields. Worse than any stench I remembered from the Siege of Jaikur, countless crows had come to banquet there. After a while, I began to feel another presence. Far off, but approaching, and I was afraid, not wanting to come face to face with Narayan's dreadful goddess. I wanted to run, but did not know how. Mergen had drawn upon years of experience when he eluded Kina. Then I realized I was not being stalked. This presence was not inimical. In fact, it was more aware of me than I of it. It was amused by my discomfort. Mergen?
"'Tis I, my apprentice. I thought you'd dream here tonight. I was right. I like being right. It's one of the joys of bachelorhood. I had forgotten until I became a haunt.
I don't think Sara would appreciate...
Of course not. Forget that. I don't have time. There are things you should know, and I won't be able to reach you again directly until you enter the dark roads on the glittering plain. Listen.
I listened. Life in Taglios was proceeding normally. The scandal at the Royal Library and disappearance of the chief librarian had been played into a major distraction by the Protector. Soulcatcher was more interested in consolidating her position than in rooting out remnants of the Black Company. After all these years, she still did not take us as seriously as we wanted. Or she was completely confident that she could root us out and exterminate us any time she felt like bothering. That being a possibility, Mergen's advice was sound. We should keep moving fast while that option was available. The best news was that Jarl Barundandi had shown an eager willingness to attach himself to the cause in hopes of avenging his wife. His initial assignment, to be carried out only if he was confident he could manage without getting caught or leaving evidence, was to penetrate the Protector's quarters and steal, destroy, or somehow incapacitate the magical carpets she had stolen from the Howler. If those could be denied her, our position would improve dramatically. He was also to recruit allies, without telling them that he was helping the Black Company. The ancient hysterical prejudice remained potent. It sounded wonderful, but I counted on nothing. Men driven solely by a need to revenge are flawed tools at best. If he let the obsession consume him, he would be lost to us before he could do any of the quiet, long-term things that make an inside man such a treasure. The bad news was bad indeed. The main party, traveling by water, had passed through the delta and was now ascending the Nagir River, meaning it was way ahead of us in terms of time still needed to reach the Shadow Gate. One Eye had suffered a stroke two nights earlier, during a drunken knockdown drag-out with his best friend Goblin. Death did not claim him. Goblin's swift intercession had prevented that. But now he suffered from a mild paralysis and the sort of perplexing speech problems that sometimes come after a stroke. The latter made it difficult for One Eye to communicate to Goblin what Goblin needed to know to cope with the problem. The words One Eye wanted to say or write were not the words that came out. A problem that is maddening enough for the ordinary analyst, coping only with time constraints and native stupidity. You cannot prepare yourself enough. The inevitable is always a shock when it lowers its evil wing. As if responding to a great joke, the circling crows rattled with dark mocking laughter. The skulls in the bone field grinned, enjoying the grand joke too. There were more minor bits of news, once Mergen exhausted his store. I asked, "Can you reach Slink if he's here? Can you put a thought into his empty head?"
"Possibly."
"Try. With this." My idea amused Mergen. He hurried off to haunt Slink's certain-to-be-strange dreams. The crows scattered, as though there was nothing interesting keeping them around anymore. I continued to people the place of nightmare, hoping I would not become a regular, as had befallen Lady and Mergen. I wondered if Lady still went there, making her interment that much more a session in hell. A crow landed high up in a barren tree, against the face of what passed for a sun in that place. I could not distinguish it, but it seemed different from the other crows.
"Sister, sister, I am with you always."
Terror reached down inside me and squeezed my heart with a fist of iron. I shot bolt upright. Panic and confusion swamped me as I grabbed for my weapons. Doge stared at me from beyond the fire.
"Nightmares."
I shivered in the cold. "Yes."
"They're the bad side of staying here. But you can learn to shut them out."
"I know what to do about them. Get away from this godforsaken place as soon as I can. Tomorrow, early, right after the deceivers turn over the key and you authenticate it." I thought I heard faint crow laughter in the night outside. Chapter 53. I took my turn on watch. I discovered that I was not the only one with problem dreams. Everyone slept poorly, including Narion. Iqbal's baby never stopped whimpering. The goats and donkeys, though not allowed inside, also bleated and snorted and whimpered all night long. The Grove of Doom is just plain a bad place. No way around that. Some things are black and white. Morning was not much more pleasant than night had been. And even before breakfast, Narion tried to sneak away. Riverwalker showed remarkable restraint in bringing him back still able to walk. "You are going to run out on me now?" I demanded. I had a good idea what he really had in mind, but did not want him to suspect I knew what had become of the friends he had expected to rescue him. "I thought you wanted that book back," he shrugged. "I had a dream last night, and it wasn't a good dream. It took me places I didn't want to go, with beings I didn't want to see. But it was a true dream. I came away with the certainty that neither of us has any chance of getting what we want if we don't fulfill our ends of our bargain. So I'm here to tell you, I'm playing it straight up. The Book of the Dead for the key." Narion betrayed a flicker of annoyance at my mention of a dream. No doubt he had hoped for divine guidance and had failed to receive it last night.
"I just wanted to look for something I left here last time I visited."
"The key?"
"No. A personal trinket."
He squatted beside the cook fire, where Mother Goda and Suruvija were preparing rice. The Radisha, to the amazement of all, was trying to help. Or, better put, was trying to learn what was being done, so she could help at another time. Neither woman offered the princess's status any special respect. Goda snarled and complained at the Radisha exactly as she would have done with the rest of us. I watched Narion eat. He used chopsticks. I had not noticed that before. Paranoid me, I searched my memory, trying to remember if Sing had used the customary wooden spoon in the past. Uncle Doge, like all Nuang Bo, used chopsticks, and he claimed they constituted some of his deadliest weapons. I was going to go crazy if I did not get Narion out of my life for a while. He smiled as though he was reading my mind. I think maybe he put too much faith in my word on behalf of the company.
"Show me the book, analyst."
I looked around. "Doge?" The man appeared in the temple doorway. What was he up to in there?
"Yes.
The Master Deceiver wishes to see the Book of the Dead."
"As you wish."
He descended the leaf-strewn outer steps, rummaged through one of the donkey packs, came up with the oilskin package we had retrieved from the Shadowlander tomb. He presented it to the deceiver with a bow and a flourish, stepped back and crossed his arms. I noted that, in some mystic manner, Ash Wand had found its way back onto his back. I recalled that Doge's adopted family bore Narion Singh and the Strangler cult an abiding grudge. Deceivers had murdered Totan, the son of Sara's brother, Tai Day. Tai Day lay buried beneath glittering stone with the captured. Uncle Doge had offered no promises to Narion Singh. I wondered if Singh knew all that. Most of it, probably, though the subject never arose in his presence. I noted also that without plan or signal, my other companions had placed themselves so that we were surrounded by armed men. Only Swan seemed unsure of his role. "Settle and have some rice," I told him.
"I hate rice, Sleepy."
"We're going places where there'll be a little more variety. I hope. I've eaten rice till it's coming out my ears, too." Narion opened the oilskins reverently, set them aside one by one, ready to be reused. The book he revealed was big and ugly, but not much distinguished it from volumes I saw every day when I was Dorby Day Bonnerjay. Nothing branded it the most holy, most sacred text of the darkest cult in the world. Narion opened it. The writing inside was completely inelegant, erratic, disorganized, and sloppy. The Daughter of Night had begun inscribing it when she was 4. As Narion turned the page, I saw that the girl was a fast learner. Her hand improved rapidly. I saw, too, that she had written in the same script used to record the first volume of the Annals. Were both in the same language? Where was Master Centaraxita when I needed him? out on the Nagir with Sara and One Eye. No doubt complaining about the accommodations and the lack of fine dining. Too bad, old man. I have the same problems here. Satisfied that it's genuine? I asked. Narion could not deny it. So I've lived up to my half of the bargain. I have, in fact, made every effort to facilitate it. The game is back to you now.
You have nothing to lose, analyst. I still wonder how I would get away from here alive.
I won't do anything to keep you from leaving. If revenge is absolutely necessary, it'll be that much sweeter down the road. Narion tried to read my true intentions. He was incapable of accepting anything at face value. On the other hand, there's no way you'll go anywhere if you don't produce the key. And we'll know if you try to pass off a substitute. I looked at Doge. Narion did the same. Then he settled into an attitude of prayer and sealed his eyes. Kina may have responded. The grove did turn icy cold. A sudden breeze brought a ghost of the odor from the place of the bones. Singh shuddered, opened his eyes.
I have to go into the temple. Alone.
Wouldn't be a back way out of there, would there? Singh smiled softly.
Would it do me any good if there were?
Not this time. Your only way out of here is not to be a deceiver.
So be it. There'll be no year of the skulls if I don't take a chance.
Let him go, I told Doge, who stood between Narion and the temple. River and Runmust, I noted, now had bamboo in hand, in case the little man made a break.
He's been in there a long time, River complained.
But he's still there, Doge assured us. The key must be well hidden.
Or not there anymore, I did not say. What are we looking at here? I asked Doge. I'm not clear on what this key is. Is it another lance head? The lance of passion had opened the plain to Croker, then had ushered the captured to their doom.
I've only heard it described. It's a strangely shaped hammer. He's about to come out.
Narion appeared. He seemed changed, invigorated, frightened. Riverwalker gestured with his bamboo. Runmust raised his slowly. Singh knew what those poles could do. He had no chance if he tried to run now. He carried what looked like a cast-iron warhammer, old, rusty, and ugly, with the head all chipped and cracked. Narion made it seem heavier than it looked. Doge? I asked. What do you think?
Fits the description, analyst, except for the head being all cracked.
Singh said.
I dropped it. It cracked when it hit the temple floor.
Feel it, Doge. If there's any power there, you ought to be able to tell. Doge did as I said once Singh surrendered the hammer. The Nuang Bo seemed startled by its weight.
This must be it, analyst.
Take your book and start running, deceiver. Before temptation makes me forget my promises. Narion clutched the book, but did not move. He stared at Suruvija and the baby. Suruvija was using a red silk scarf to dab spit up off the infant's chin.
Fools.
Idiots. Chapter 54. While we were getting ready to travel, one of Iqbal's kids, the older boy, noticed a particularly deep flaw in the head of the hammer. The rest of us had been too busy congratulating ourselves and deciding what the company would do once we brought the captured forth from the plane. The boy got his father's attention. Iqbal summoned Runmust and me. Being old folks, it took us a while to see what the boy meant. Us having bad eyes and all.
Looks like gold in there.
That would explain the weight. Doge, come here. You ever hear anything about this hammer being gold inside? Iqbal began prying with a knife. A fragment of iron fell away.
No, Doge said. Don't damage it anymore.
Everybody calmed down. It's still the key. Doge, study it. Carefully. I don't want all the years and all the crap we went through to go to waste now. What? Weapons had begun to appear.
Look who's here, Swan said. Where did those guys come from?
Slink and his band had arrived. I exchanged looks with Slink. He shrugged.
Give us the slip.
I'm not surprised. We screwed up here. He knew somebody was out there. Suruvija still had the red scarf draped over her shoulder. Folks, we need to get traveling. We want to get across the bridge at Goja before the Protector starts looking for us. From the beginning, I had pretended that getting across that bridge would give us a running chance. I told Slink, "You guys did a great job at Semki."
Could have been better, if I'd thought about it. I'd have waited till they damaged the Bodhi tree. Then we'd have been heroes instead of just bandits.
I shrugged. Next time. Swan, tell that goat we're going to eat it if it don't start cooperating.
You promise?
I promise. We'll get some real food when we get to Jaikur. Chapter 55. Our crossing at Goja was another grand anticlimax. We all worked ourselves into a state of nerves before we reached the bottleneck. I sent Slink forward to scout and did not believe a word, emotionally, when he reported the only attention being paid anyone went to those few travelers who argued about paying a 2 copper pace toll for use of the bridge. These tightwads were commended to the old ford downstream from the bridge, a ford that was impassable because this was the rainy season. Traffic was heavy. The soldiers assigned to watch the bridge were too busy loafing and playing cards to harass wayfarers. Some part of me was determined to expect the worst. Goja had grown into a small town serving those who traveled the Rock Road, which was one of the Black Company's lasting legacies. The captain had had the highway paved from Taglios to Jaikur during his preparations for invading the Shadowlands. Prisoners of war had provided the labor. More recently, Mogaba had used convicts to extend the road southwestward, adding tributaries to connect the cities and territories newly taken under Taglian protection. Once we were safely over the main, I began to ponder our next step. I gathered everyone. Is there any way we could forge a rescript ordering the garrison here to arrest Narion if he crosses the bridge? Doge told me,
You're too optimistic. If he's going south, he's already ahead of us.
Swan added, Not to mention that if he fell into the Protector's hands, she'd find out everything he knows about you. The voice of an expert heard.
I didn't take the job voluntarily.
All right. She could, yes. He knows where we're headed. And why. And that we have the key. But what does he know about the other bunch? If he doesn't get caught, won't he try to intercept them so he can do something about getting the Daughter of Night away from them? No one found any cause to disagree. I suggest we remind one another of that occasionally so it gets said sometime when Mergen is around to hear it. Sara never promised to spare Narion's ragged old hide. Maybe she could ambush him and take back that unfinished first book of the dead. Swan pointed out,
That crow is still following us.
A small but lofty fortification overlooked the bridge and ford from the south bank. The bird was up top watching us. It had not moved since our crossing. Maybe it wanted to rest its bones too. River whispered,
We still have one bamboo pole with crow-killing balls in it.
Leave it alone. It doesn't seem to mean any harm. For now, anyway. I was sure it had tried to communicate several times. We can take it out if anything changes. At Goja, we heard nothing but the traditional grumbling about those in charge. Rumors concerning events in Taglios seemed so exaggerated that no one believed a tenth of anything they heard. Later, after we reached Jaikur and were taking it easy for a while, the temper of rumor began to change. It now carried a subtle vibration suggesting the great spider at the heart of the web had begun to stir. It would be a long time before any concrete news caught up, but the general consensus was that we should get going right now and not dawdle along the way. Runmust discovered that a man answering Narion's description had been seen lurking in the vicinity of the shop operated by his now pseudonymous offspring, Sugriva.
"The man does have a weakness. Should we kill Sugriva while we're here?
He's never done anything to us.
His father did. It would be a reminder to him.
He doesn't need reminding. If Narion is so dim that he thinks we're done with him now, let him. Just let me be there to see the look on his face when we catch him again." Narion had stood out in Jaikur, because the city was still very nearly a military encampment. People would remember us as well, if asked during the next few weeks. I roamed around looking for my childhood a few times, but nothing that I remembered, people or places, good or evil, remained. That past survived nowhere but within my mind, which was the one place I wished that it could die.
Chapter 56.
The practical rules of company field operations resemble those obeyed by stage magicians. We would prefer our audience saw nothing at all, but we do realize that invisibility is impractical. So we try to show the watcher something other than what he is looking for, thus the goats and donkeys. And south of Jaikur, all new looks and identities for everybody, with the enlarged party breaking up into two independently traveling families, plus a group of failed southern fortune hunters dragging home in despair and defeat after having had their spirits crushed by the Taglian experience. There were quite a few men of the latter sort around. They had to be watched. Many were not above taking advantage of weaker parties if they thought they could manage it. The roads were not patrolled anymore. The protector did not care if they were safe. Doge and Swan, Goda and I, formed the advance party. We looked weak, but that old man was worth four or five ordinary mortals. We had only one scrape. It was over in seconds. Several blood trails led off into the brush. Doge had chosen to leave no one dead. The land became less hospitable and rose steadily. In clear air it was possible to look ahead and catch the faintest glimpse of the peaks of the Don de Preche, still many days' journey south of us. The paved road ended alongside an abandoned work camp.
"They must have run out of prisoners," Swan observed.
The camp had been stripped of everything portable. What they ran out of, his enemy's soulcatcher thought, were worth an investment in a road. She could always find people she doesn't like and use them up in an engineering project. And she had done so on the western route, which was being followed by the rest of the company. They would have paved footing all the way to Tarandaprash. Their road, and the waterways serving it, had remained under construction until just a few years ago, when the Protector evidently decided the Kialune Wars really were over, that it was not necessary to make life easy for the great general and his men, and bullied the Radisha into no longer spending the money. I wondered what the Radisha's perspective would be. I suspected she had believed she was in charge right up to the moment we disappeared her. Then she had begun getting an education, here amongst her faithful subjects. We reached Lake Tanji, which I love. The lake is a vast sprawl of icy indigo beauty. When I was a lot younger, we fought our deadliest encounter with the things that had given the Shadow Masters their names here. More than a decade later, you could still see places where rock had melted. If you went exploring some of the narrow gulches scarring the hillsides, you could find clutches of human bones that had come back to the surface with time.
"This is a place of dark memory," Doge remarked.
He had been here for that battle too, and so had Goda, who had stopped complaining long enough to deal with her memories also. She really did have a lot of pain these days. The white crow streaked overhead. It dropped down the slope ahead, vanished into the ragged foliage of a tall mountain pine. We saw that bird almost every day now. There was no doubt it was following us. Swan swore that it had tried to strike up a conversation with him once when he was out in the brush, relieving himself. When I asked what it wanted, he said,
"Hey, I got the hell out of there, Sleepy. I've got problems enough. I don't need to get known as a guy who gossips with birds, too."
He might have had something interesting to say. Without a doubt. And if it really wants to tell somebody something badly enough, it'll come talk to you. Right now, Swan looked down the slope and said,
"It's hiding from something."
But not from us. I looked back up the slope. The ground appeared untouched up there. There was no sign of other travelers. Below me, downhill, the meandering track appeared occasionally upon the slope and along the shore, both of which were deserted. This was no longer a popular route. "I could retire beside that lake," I told Swan.
"Must not be the best place, or somebody would have beaten you to it."
He had a point. This country was far emptier now than it had been 20 years ago. Then there had been villages around the lake.
"There you go," Swan said, looking back.
"What?" I looked. It took a moment. "Oh, the bird?"
"Not just a bird, a crow. The regular kind of crow."
"Your eyes are better than mine. Ignore it. If we don't pay it any special attention, it shouldn't have any reason to concentrate on us." My heartbeat was rising, though. Maybe it was just a feral crow and had nothing to do with Soulcatcher. Crows are not fastidious about their dining. Or maybe the Protector had, at last, begun looking for us outside of Taglios. White crow in hiding, black crow in the air, searching. What did it mean? Not much we could do about it, whatever. Though Uncle Doge had a calculating eye whenever he looked up at the black crow. It lost interest after a while. It went away. I told the others, "That shouldn't be a problem. Crows are smart for birds. But one by itself can't remember a lot of instructions or carry much information back. If it is one of hers." We had to assume that it was. Crows were much less common than they used to be. Those remaining always seemed to be under Soulcatcher's control. Her control was probably why they were dying out. If this one was a scout for the Protector, it would be days yet before it could report. Doge observed,
"If it was suspicious, we can expect to have shadows around in a few days."
That would be Soulcatcher's best means of scouting us. Shadows traveled faster than crows, could be given much more complex instructions, and could bring back far more information. But could Soulcatcher control them so far away? The original Shadow Masters had had major difficulties managing their pets over long distances. We passed along the shores of Lake Tanji. Each of us seized an opportunity to bathe in the icy water. The old road then led us on to the plain of Tarandaprash, where the Black Company had won one of its greatest triumphs and the great general had suffered his most humiliating defeat, through no fault of his own. Though a capricious history would not recall the blame due his cowardly master, Long Shadow, wreckage from that battle still lay scattered across the slopes. A small garrison watched over the approaches to the pass through the Dondeprech. It showed no interest in clearing any mess or even in monitoring traffic. Nobody looked my group over. Nobody asked questions. We were assessed an unofficial toll and warned that the donkey might find the footing treacherous in the high pass because there was still ice on the rocks up there. We did learn that there had been heavier traffic than usual lately. That told me that Sara's group had encountered no insuperable difficulties and was ahead of us, as it should be, even with all the old men and reluctant companions. The mountains were far colder and more barren than the highlands we had crossed. I wondered how the Radisha was handling it, about her thoughts concerning the empire she had acquired, mostly thanks to the company. Doubtless her eyes had been opened some. They needed a lot of opening. She had spent most of her life cooped up inside the palace. The White Crow turned up every few days, but its darker kinfolk did not. Maybe the Protector was preoccupied elsewhere. I wished I had Mergen's talent for leaving his body. I had not had so much as a good dream since leaving the Grove of Doom. I knew exactly as little as everyone else. And that was extremely frustrating after having had easy access to secrets from afar for so long. Nights in the mountains get really cold. I told Swan I was tempted to take up his suggestion that we'd go off somewhere and set up housekeeping in our own tavern and brewery. When it got really cold, a few lesser sins did not seem to matter. Chapter 57 The timing of events in Taglios is uncertain because the principal reporter, Mergen, had maintained such a casual relationship with the concept for the last decade and a half. But his sketchy descriptions of events in the city, following our departure, are of more than passing interest. At first, the Protector suspected nothing. The stay-behinds planted smoke buttons and started rumors, but with a declining enthusiasm the Taglian peoples began to sense. At the same time, though, the populace developed an abiding suspicion that the Protector had done away with the reigning princess. The people became less tractable by the hour. The arrival of the great general and his forces guaranteed the peace. Moreover, it freed the Protector to go hunting enemies instead of spending her time making sure her friends remained intimidated enough to continue supporting her. In just days, she found the Nuengbo warehouse on the waterfront. Empty now except for a few cages occupied by missing members of the Privy Council, none of whom were in shape to resume their duties. An armamentarium of booby traps came with the prodigal ministers, of course, but none of those were clever enough to inconvenience Soulcatcher herself. Quite a few greys were not so fortunate. The Protector took rather a heartless view of those who did fall victim to the company legacy.
Better to get the dimwits winnowed out now, when the broader risk is minimal, she told Mugaba. The great general's attitude complemented hers precisely.
Questions asked in the neighborhood produced no information of substance, however vigorously they were put. The Nuengbo merchants had been careful to maintain a veil around themselves and their businesses. They had even employed the magical in their quest for greater anonymity. Wisps of confusion spells persisted yet.
"I smell those two wizards," Soulcatcher muttered. "But you promised me that they were dead, didn't you, great general?" "I saw them die myself."
"You'd better hope you don't irritate me so much you don't survive to see them die again for real."
Her voice was that of a spoiled child. The great general did not respond. If Soulcatcher frightened him, he showed no sign. Neither did he betray any anger. He waited, reasonably confident that he was too valuable to become the victim of an evil caprice. Perhaps, in his heart of hearts, he thought the Protector was not equally valuable.
"There's no trace of them,"
Soulcatcher mumbled later in a voice academically cool.
"They're gone."
Yet the impression of their presence persists, as bold as a bucket of blood thrown against a wall.
"Illusion," Mugaba said. "I'm sure you'd find 100 instances in the Black Company annals of where they drew an enemy's eye in one direction while they moved in another. Or made someone believe their numbers were far greater than they actually were."
"You'd find as many instances in my diaries, if I bothered to keep any. I don't, because books are nothing but repositories for those lies the author wants his reader to believe."
The voice she used now was the antithesis of academic. It was that of a man who knew, from painful experience, that education just taught people sneakier ways to rob you.
"They aren't here anymore, but they may have left spies."
"Of course they did. It's doctrine. But you'll have a hell of a time finding them. They won't be people anyone else would suspect.
Jal Barandandi and two of his assistants laid out a dinner while the Protector and her champion talked. The presence attracted no notice. Paranoid, though she was, Soulcatcher paid little heed to the furniture. Every staffer had been interrogated in the hours following the Radish's disappearance, and no inside accomplices had been found. The Protector was not unaware that she was not as beloved of the staff as the Radisha had been. But she was not troubled. No mundane attacker had any genuine hope of penetrating her personal defenses, and these days she had no peer in this world. Sheer perversity and protracted elusiveness had put her in a position to elect herself queen of the world, if she wanted to bother. Someday, when she got her head organized, she was going to have to think about that. Halfway through a rare meal, Soulcatcher paused in mid-chew. She told Mogaba,
"Find me a Nuang Bo. Any Nuang Bo. Right now. Right away."
The lean black man showed no emotion as he rose.
"May I ask why?"
"Their headquarters was inside the Nuang Bo warehouse. Nuang Bo have been associated with the company since the fighting at Dejagore. The last analyst married one of them. He had a child by her. The association may be more than historical happenstance."
She knew a great deal more about Nuang Bo than she was willing to share, of course. Mugaba inclined his upper body in a ghost of a bow. Mostly he was comfortable working with Soulcatcher. Mostly he approved of her thinking. He went in search of someone who could catch him a couple of swamp monkeys. The servants hovered around the Protector, perfectly attentive. Idly, she noted that these three were among the same half-dozen who struggled to make her life easier wherever she happened to be in the palace. In fact, one or more always followed her on her exploratory safaris into the maze of abandoned corridors that made up the majority of the palace, just in case she needed something. Lately they had brought life into her personal quarters, which for so long had been as chill and barren and dusty as the empty sectors. It was their nature. It was bred into them. They must serve. Without the Radisha to fulfill their need for a master, they had had to turn to her. Mogaba was away hours longer than she liked. When the man did deign to return, her voice of choice was spoiled brat querulous.
"Where have you been? What took you so long?"
"I've been demonstrating how hard it is to catch the wind. There are no Nuang Bo anywhere in the city. The last time anyone can remember seeing any of them was the day before yesterday. In the morning, they were going aboard a barge that later headed downriver, toward the swamps. Evidently the swamp people have been leaving Taglio since before the Radisha disappeared, and you hurt your heel."
Soulcatcher growled. She did not want to be reminded that she had been tricked. The heel itself was reminder enough.
"The Nuang Bo are a stubborn people."
"Famous for it,"
Mogaba agreed.
"I've visited them twice before."
"Each time they failed to appreciate my full message."
"I suppose I'll have to preach to them again, and round up any fugitives they've taken in."
It was an obvious conclusion that the company's survivors had retreated into the swamps. The Nuang Bo had taken in fugitives before, and supportive evidence was available if the Protector cared to dig. The barges carrying the majority of the company had gone downriver. You had to go down into the delta to get to the Nagir River, which was the principal navigable waterway leading into the south. Soulcatcher popped up. She rushed out with the bounce and enthusiasm of a teenager. Mogaba settled down to contemplate the remains of his meal, which had not yet been cleared away. One of the servants murmured,
"We thought you might wish to continue, sir. Should you prefer otherwise, we will clear away instantly."
Mogaba looked up into a bland face that projected eagerness to serve. Nevertheless, he had a momentary impression that the man was measuring his back for a dagger.
Take it away. I'm not hungry.
As you wish, sir. Girish, take the leftovers to the charity postern. Make certain the beggars there know that the protector is thinking of them.
Mogaba watched the servants depart. He wondered what had given him the impression that that man was insincere. The truth supposedly lay in a man's deeds, and that one never behaved as anything less than a totally devoted servant. Soulcatcher stamped into her personal suite. The more she thought about the Nuang Bo, the more enraged she became. What would it take to teach those people? That seemed like something they could work out between them before the sun came up. A night of shadow terror ought, at the very least, to put them into a mood to pay attention. Soulcatcher understood herself better than outsiders believed she did. She wondered why she was in so foul a temper, which seemed to go beyond her usual caprice and irritability. She belched, hammered her chest with a fist to loosen another burp. Maybe it was the spicy food. She sensed bad heartburn coming. She felt a little lightheaded, too. She climbed to the parapet, where she kept the only two flying carpets left in the world. That could be reached only by the route she followed. She would go down there and make those swamp monkeys pay for the heartburn, too. Dinner had been a Nuang Bo ethnic specialty consisting of big, ugly mushrooms, uglier eels, and unidentifiable vegetables in a blisteringly spicy sauce, served upon a bed of rice. It had been a favorite of the Radishes, served often. The kitchens had not changed their routines, because the protector did not care about the menu. The protector belched again. The growing heartburn seared her insides. She jumped on the larger carpet. It creaked under her weight. She ordered it to head downriver, fast. A few miles out, 400 feet above the rooftops, streaking faster than a racing pigeon, sabotaged frame members under the carpet began to snap. Once the first went, the stress became too much for the others. The carpet disintegrated in seconds. A burst of light flared bright enough to be seen by half the city. The last thing Soulcatcher saw, as she arced toward the surface of the river, was a huge circle of characters declaring, "Water sleeps." Just before the flash leaped through his window, a bemused Mogaba discovered a folded, sealed letter on his Spartan cot. Belching, glad he had eaten no more of that spicy food, he broke the wax and read, "My brother unforgiven." Then the unexpected lightning grabbed his attention. He read the slogan in the sky, too. All the labor he had invested in learning to read over the past few years was to be rewarded thus? What now? If the protector was gone, pretend she was in hiding, too, and make the deceit a double veil? He belched again, settled down on his cot. He did not feel well at all. That was a baffling new feeling for him. He never got sick. Chapter 58. A chatty youngster of native stock and a more than customarily ambitious disposition interviewed us at the military control point we encountered at the southern end of the pass. He was not yet old enough to be pompously officious, but he would get there. Personally, he seemed more interested in foreign news than in contraband or wanted men.
"What's going on up north?" he wanted to know. "We've seen a lot of refugees lately."
He examined our meager possessions without ever looking inside anything. Goda and Doge rattled at one another in Nuang Bo and pretended not to understand the young man's accented Taglian. I shrugged and responded in Jekuri at first, which is close enough to Taglian for the two peoples to understand one another most of the time. But here it only frustrated the young official. I had no desire to stand around gossiping with a functionary.
"I do not know about others. We have had nothing but decades of misfortune and suffering. We heard there were opportunities down here, so we abandoned the land of our sorrows and came."
The official assumed I meant a particular country, as I had hoped, rather than recognizing that the land of our sorrows was the Vedna way of describing where a convert lived before he became acquainted with God.
"You say there are many others doing the same as us?"
I tried to sound troubled.
"Recently, yes, which is why I feared something might be afoot."
He feared for the stability of the empire to which he had attached himself. I could not resist a prank.
"There were rumors that the Black Company had surfaced in Taglios and was warring with the Protector.
But there are always crazy stories about the Black Company. They never mean anything, and they had nothing to do with our decision." The young man became more unhappy. He passed us through without further interest. I did not bother commending him, but he was the only official we had encountered since leaving Taglios who was making a serious effort to perform his duties. And he was doing it only in hopes of getting ahead. I never had to bring out the richly complex legend I have invented for our foursome, in which Swan was my second husband, Goda the mother of my deceased first spouse, and Doge her cousin, all of us survivors of the wars. The story would have played in any region where there had been any extended fighting. Splatch-cobbled family survival teams were not at all uncommon. I complained. "I worked on weaving us a history all the way down here, and I never got to use it. Not once. Nobody's doing their job."
Doge smiled and winked and vanished into the broken ground beside the road, off to reclaim the weapons we had hidden before approaching the checkpoint.
"Somebody should do something about that," Swan declared. "Next Vice-Regal sub-officer, I see. I'll march right up and give him a piece of my mind. We all pay taxes. We have a right to expect more effort from our officials."
Goda woke up long enough to call Swan an idiot in Taglian and Yuang Bo. She told him he ought to shut up before even the god of fools renounced him. Then she closed her eyes and resumed snoring. Goda had begun to concern me. She had shown less life every day for the past few months. Doge seemed to think she believed she no longer had anything to live for. Maybe Sara could get her going again. We should be joining up with the others before long. Maybe Sara could get her excited about rescuing Tai Dei and the captured. I was troubled about consequences. All these years I had striven toward the undertaking we would launch before long, and now, for the first time, I had begun to wonder what success might really mean. Those people buried out there never were paragons of sanity and righteousness. They had had almost 2 decades to ferment in their own juices. They were unlikely to entertain much brotherly love toward the rest of the world. And then there was the guardian demon Shivetya. And, somewhere, the enchanted and unchained thing worshipped by Narayan Singh and the Daughter of Night, not to mention the mysteries and dangers of the plane itself, and all the perils we did not yet know. Only Swan had any experience of that. He had nothing positive to report. Nor had Mergen at any time over the years, though his experiences had been dramatically different from Swan's. Mergen had experienced the glittering plane in 2 worlds at once. Swan seemed to have experienced the version in our world in sharper focus. Even after so many years, he could describe particular landmarks in exquisite detail.
"How come you never talked about this before?"
"I never hid it, Sleepy. But there just don't seem to be much percentage in volunteering anything in this world. If I admit anything I know about that place, next thing I'll know is good old Willow Swan is elected to go back up there as the guide for a gang of invaders guaranteed to irritate the shit out of whatever spirits haunt the place. Am I right, or am I right?"
"You aren't as stupid as you let on. I thought you didn't see any spirits."
"Not the way Mergen claimed he saw them, but that don't mean I didn't feel them creeping around. You'll find out. You try to sleep at night when you feel hungry shadows calling you from a few feet away. It's like being inside a zoo with all the predators in the world slavering just the other side of the bars. Bars that you can't see, and can't even feel, and so have no way of knowing if they're trustworthy. And all this jabber ain't doing my nerves any good at all neither, Sleepy."
"We may never have to go up there, Swan, if the key we've got is a fake or isn't any good anymore. Then there won't be anything we can do but maybe set up your brewery and pretend we never heard of the Protector or the Radisha or the Black Company.
Be still my heart. You know goddamn well that thing's going to be the true key. Your god, my gods, somebody's gods have got a boner for Willow Swan, and they're going to keep making sure that whatever happens, it's going to be the worst possible thing, and it's going to happen to me. I ought to run out on you now. I ought to turn you in to the nearest royal official. Only that would let Soulcatcher know that I'm still alive. Then she'd get real nasty, asking me why I didn't turn you in 3-4 months ago.
Not to mention you'd probably get yourself dead long before you could unearth an official who cared enough to listen to you.
There's that, too.
Doge came back with the weapons. We passed them around. Resumed traveling. Swan continued eloquently describing himself as the firstborn son of misfortune. He went through these spells of high drama. A half mile down the road we encountered a small peasant's market. A few old folks and youngsters who could not contribute much on the farm waited to take advantage of travelers still shaking from the miseries of the mountains. Fresh foods in season were their hot sellers, but they retailed gossip at no charge as long as you contributed a few snippets of your own. They found doings beyond the Don de Preche particularly intriguing.
I asked a young girl, who looked like she could be the little sister of the customs official back up the road.
Do you remember many of the people who came through here? My father was supposed to have come down ahead of us, to find us a place to settle. I proceeded to describe Narayan Singh in detail. The child was a light-hearted thing, without a care or concern. Chances are she did not recall what she had eaten for breakfast. She did not remember Narayan, but went off to find someone who might.
"Where was she when I was young enough to get married?" Swan grumbled. "She'll be pretty when she's older. And she doesn't have a brain in her head to complicate things."
"Buy her. Bring her along. Raise her upright."
"I'm not as pretty as I used to be."
I tried to think of someone who was. Not even Sara qualified. I waited. Swan muttered. Doge and Goda wandered around, Uncle swapping tales and Mother examining the wares for sale. Except for the produce, those were feeble. She did acquire a scrawny chicken. The one positive of our travel team was that there were no Guni or Shadar to complicate mealtime. Only Goda, who kept trying to do the cooking. Maybe I could murder the chicken in her sleep and get it roasted before she woke up. The girl brought a very old man. He was no help either. He seemed interested only in telling me what he thought I wanted to hear. But it did seem possible that Narayan had come through the pass some time before we had. I hoped Mergen was on the job and had alerted the others to the possibilities. Doge and Goda headed on down the road before I finished with the locals, surprised that my command of the language was adequate to the task. Evidently Goda was tired of riding. The donkey certainly could use the break.
"Is that a pet?"
the small girl asked.
"It's a donkey,"
I said, really astonished that I had been having so little trouble communicating. They had donkeys down here, did they not?
"I know that. I meant the bird."
"Huh? Well..." The white crow was perched on the donkey's pack. It winked. It laughed. It said,
"Sister! Sister!"
and flapped into the air, then glided on down the mountain. Swan said,
"I was just thinking I found an upside to this trip. It's not raining down here.
Maybe I'll see if they'll let me have the child in exchange for your strong back."
"We're getting a little too domestic here, good wife."
"Sleepy? Didn't you ever have a real name?"
"Anyanyadir, the lost princess of Jaikur. But even now my wicked stepmother has discovered that I still live and has summoned the princes of the Rakshasas to bargain with them for my murder."
"Hey, I'm kidding. I'm sleepy. And you've known me practically since I started being sleepy, off and on. So just let it be." Chapter 59. Once we cleared the mountains, it was no long journey to the site of Kialune. Incredible destruction had been wrought there during the Shadowmaster Wars, then during the Kialune Wars between the Radisha and those who chose to keep faith with the Black Company. A pity most of the wreckage had been cleared away even before Soulcatcher decided she would declare victory and go north to claim her new place as protector of all the Taglias. The Radisha should have seen it at its worst. To understand what she had wrought by betraying her contract with the company. But the worst now existed only in the memories of survivors. The once clamorous valley now boasted a sizable town and a checkerboard of new farms peopled by a mixture of natives, former prisoners of war, and deserters from every conceivable faction. Peace had broken out and was being enthusiastically exploited on the presumption that it could not possibly last. The transition from the old Kialune, once called Shadow Catch, and the new, simply called the New Town, saw one thing remain unchanged. Over there on the far slope of the valley, miles and miles away, beyond the crumbled, brush-strewn ruins of once mighty Overlook, where the land quickly changed from rich green to almost barren brown, was the dreaded thing called the Shadow Gate. It did not stand out, but I felt its call. I told my companions, "We have to be careful not to get in a hurry now. Haste could be deadly." The Shadow Gate was not just the only way we could get up onto the plain to go free the captured. It was also the only portal through which the shadows imprisoned up there could escape and begin treating the whole world the way their cousins had the destitute of Taglios. And that gate was in tender shape. The Shadow Masters had endured and weakened it badly when gaining access to the shadows they enslaved.
"We're in complete agreement on that," Uncle Doge replied. "All the lore emphasizes the need for caution."
There had been some disagreement between us lately. He had resumed his romance with the idea of the company analyst becoming his understudy and the peculiar role he played among the Nuang Bo. The company analyst, who had no great interest in the job, but Doge was one of those people who just have grave difficulties getting their minds around the concept. "No." "That's new," I said, indicating a small structure a quarter mile below the Shadow Gate beside the road. "And I don't like its looks." It was hard to tell from so far, but the structure looked like a small fortification built of stones salvaged from the rubble of Overlook. Doge grunted.
"A potential complication,"
Swan observed.
"We keep standing around looking like spies. Somebody's going to get unpleasant with us."
A point not without substance, although those in charge seemed awfully lax. It was obvious that trouble had not visited in a while. Quite probably not since the Black Company left. Somebody, probably named me, because I'm the only one here who looks like what she says she is, will have to go scout around. The original plan had been for everybody to camp in the barrens not far downhill from where that new structure now stood. I was troubled. Someone should have been watching for us to come out of the mountains. I hoped that was just Sara's oversight. She had been married to the company for an age, but never did learn to think like a soldier. If nobody offered good advice, or she chose to ignore the advice she was given because, like many civilians, she could not grasp why all the little horse-pucky things have to be done, she might not have thought it important to watch for us. I prayed it was as simple as that. Nobody demanded that I give them the role of scout. Poor me. More sore feet, while the rest of them loafed around in the shade of young pines. The White Crow materialized minutes after I turned the knee of a hill, and the others were out of sight. It swooped at me and squawked. It swooped at me again. I tried to swat it like it was some huge, really annoying bug. It laughed and came back, now squawking what sounded like words. I got it. Finally. The bird wanted me to follow it. "Lead on, fell harbinger, never forgetting that I'm not Goonie, and therefore hobbled by no holy ban against eating meat."
I had enjoyed, if that is the proper word, crow stew several times during the lowest lows of my military career. The crow had only my interests at heart. It led me straight to a large tent village on a hillside overlooking the near outskirts of the new town. Our people had to be only some of the refugees housed there, but Sarah's hand was obvious everywhere. The layout was neat and orderly and clean, exactly as the captain's rules insisted, though those are honored mainly in the breach when he is not around. I suffered an immediate conflict. Charge ahead to see everyone I had missed for months, or run back and collect my traveling companions. Once I started grabbing, it might be hours before... My choice got made for me. Tobo spotted me. My first warning was a shout.
Sleepy!
A mass of churning arms and legs charged in from the left and collected me in a totally unexpected hug. I wriggled loose.
You've grown!
A lot. He was taller than me now, and his voice had deepened. You won't be able to be Shiki anymore. The great men of Taglios will be broken-hearted. Goblin says it's time I start breaking the girls' hearts anyway. There was not much doubt that he would have the power to do that. He was going to be a handsome man who had no lack of confidence. Uncharacteristically, I slipped an arm around his waist and walked down toward where other familiar faces had begun to appear.
How was your journey?
Mostly kind of fun. Except when they made me study, which was about all the time. Shri Surendranath is worse than Goblin, but he says I could be a scholar. So Mother always backs them up, whenever anybody wants to make me study. But we got to see a lot of neat things. There was this temple in Pryferbed that was completely covered with carvings of people doing it all different ways. Oh, I'm sorry. He reddened. Tobo had a mental image of me as a sort of chaste nun, and most of my adult life would not contradict that view. But I am not against interpersonal adventures. I'm just not interested myself. Probably because Swan insists, I have not yet run into the man whose animal presence completely overwhelms my intellectual reluctance. Swan being a leading authority in his own mind. He keeps volunteering. Who knows? Maybe someday I will become curious enough to experiment, just to find out if I can be touched without running away to my place to hide. Now the others were wishing me welcome, with a sincerity that set another place inside me. A small, warm place, all aglow. My comrades, my brothers, all kinds of rattle and chatter inundated me. Now we were going to do something. Now we were going to get something.